Hey, this is Richard.
And this is Eric.
And you're listening to the Coral Contrarians Podcast. Rainy, cold day here in Northern Virginia. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Would you consider it blustery?
Blustery, a little dreary, a bit of drear.
Like Winnie the Pooh, blustery kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Okay. I could see that. Totally.
Nobody wants to hear about any of this. Let's get to the meat, right to it today. Nobody wants to hear about our lives.
Nobody wants to hear about our lives.
Nobody wants to hear about how you're doing.
Our public.
That's the truth. They don't want to hear.
Our valued listeners across the world.
In
far flung.
In Tanzania, they're saying, chip chop, get to it.
get on with it.
No, I'm kidding.
That's right.
I'm glad you're doing good. I'm doing fine. I'm starting to really sense the lack of sunlight in the northern hemisphere. So if you live farther away from the equator, you experience significantly less sun. I don't know if that's really a revelation, a scientific revelation, but there are days that when it gets dark at like 4:30, it's a thing. It's hard. It's tough.
That feeling when you walk out of the office, you came into the office in the dark, you walk out of the office in the dark, that special moment, right?
It's a special moment. But anyway, I know we have another month of it, and then we're back, back on the road towards more sun. So it's those days. It's those days, and here we are living it.
Here we are doing it.
We're doing it. Anyway, I'm excited to talk about whatever we're going to talk about. That's what I'm excited
too.
About.
I am pumped, and it's great to be here with you. So let's carry on with with some sweet sounds of Coral Contrarians.
That's right. The sweet
sounds. I can't get that out of my head.
Of the Coral Contrarians.
Okay, so today we've got an interesting topic that was suggested to me by my wife, who sent along an article and said, what do you think of this? So I'm going to lay out some context here, read a little bit of the article, and then I thought we might just take the ball and run, Eric. So let's give it a go, shall we?
Indeed.
All right.
I said with a smirk, as ChatGPT told me to say.
Smirkingly.
No, I'm kidding.
All right. This article is recent, published in November of this year, 2023, in The Critic, which is a UK publication. It is by Norman Lebrecht. The title of this article is, Have I Seen the Future of Music? On a performance in three dimensions for all five senses. And since the article lays out a question, I thought, well, we're in the business of wrestling with questions and coming up with half-baked answers, so let's see where this article takes us. The summary of the article is that there is an art exhibition, of the English artist David Hockney, who is a an artist who is still living and is a famous artist associated with the, I guess he came onto the scene in the 60s and beyond, and might be considered a modern, postmodern, you know, late pop. Different ways you might think about this artist. And I really appreciate his work, and I think it's interesting and you know, evocative and all of that. So I was interested to read this article. Apparently, the famed pianist and virtuosic, you know, current star of the piano, Yuja Wang, has accompanied this exhibition and played a recital within this exhibition, and then asked for those in attendance not to reveal what had happened. Like, this was for her kind of a workshop opportunity, just to, you know, see if it worked, maybe something that she's thinking about for the future, maybe not. But anyway, this critic decided this was too good to not write about. So Eric, I'll read a little bit of this article, and then let's give it a go. Norman Lebrecht begins, "Possibly the last thing I expected to run into in this life was Yuja Wang playing Pierre Boulez at a David Hockney exhibition in a box room behind London's Eurostar terminal. The incongruities are so fantastically disparate. They defeat the act of criticism, which is helpful, since the organizers made us sign a prior undertaking not to review the event. It was, they said, an experiment by the Chinese-US pianist. Her repertoire decisions were spontaneous, and the video elements might be controversial."
Richard, can I come in right now, first off?
Of course.
So this review critic is admitting publicly to have signed a document not to review.
Yeah.
And then he reviewed.
So we got some issues right up front.
No, I mean, how? What kind of document did they sign? NDA, whatever. I can do what I want.
Yeah.
Amazing. It's, what?
Whatever it was, must, yeah.
Was it
must,
in must crayon? Not have had... Maybe it was in crayon. It was
maybe, or pencil. Review. Erased it.
I'm just kidding. Anyway, sorry to interrupt. I just found that truly fascinating to be asked not to review and then immediately write a review.
Amazing. Well, let's say, you know, the review is a tad hyperbolic, perhaps. So the next line here explains, "All these arguments struck me as perfectly reasonable. I had no problem at all signing up to the review ban. Up to the midpoint, that is, when I felt what I was witnessing in the King's Cross Lightroom might actually be the future of concerts for the rest of the century. And if that were so, I would be professionally obligated to share the event with history. Sorry, Yuja." So there you go. That's laying it out.
So I'm willing to summarize, risk my career.
Gonna risk the career to lay it out.
Because it's that good. Whatever was
this retrospective, the Hockney retrospective, which I had heard about before, called Bigger and Closer, has been running since February. This artist's work, life's work, is presented in a small room and projected on walls. You can go to YouTube if you're listening, and you can see what the exhibition kind of looks like. You know, walls are filled with stuff, and you're seeing things in close up, and it's kind of probably a weird experience when you're there and you're surrounded by the art, and it's kind of an immersive thing. Yuja Wang, the author, writes of this article, "Seeing Bigger and Closer, decided that Hockney could be even more effective with music. She drew up a piano playlist to accompany the images, ranging from Satie Jean-Nopéry, Perfect for a Poolside, to Nikolai Medtner, Bach, Liszt, Shostakovich at his darkest, the final pages of Tchaikovsky's Pathetic Symphony, and Philip Glass. It took under an hour to play."
Wait,
the author,
Richard.
Yes, go
I'm
ahead.
I'm going to keep interjecting because it's amazing.
Okay, please do.
Is that Satie piece Perfect for a Poolside? Have you ever played settee at the poolside?
I think it's kind of chill.
Also,
I think it's good. It's
can you imagine? Didn't you do a special tribute to one of Satie's choral works? What was that?
I did. That was one of our, what was it, Musica Obscura? That was one of the little features. We should bring those back, by the way. Maybe you and I could.
Yes, we need to. But
we could listen to a piece of music and then just kind of riff on it.
That would be
you
good.
Know during the that would be
but
kind
what,
of interesting.
What was that? What was that settee?
So that was an unfinished mass, I think, is what that was, or a piece of sacred music.
Yes.
Because he had like invented his own religion and had done this stuff, and that was kind of a cool and weird thing.
What would that?
That we're
be?
Still waiting.
Yeah.
You know,
what would that
for
be
for choral directors?
What would that be perfect for? Like the tub side,
like picture wise.
No, the tub.
Yeah, tub side.
Tub side. I just think it's amazing that he decided to put perfect for the poolside after that piece. I don't know. It just is so amazing. Anyway, keep going. Sorry to interject. Sorry.
So apparently, while you're watching this. This immersive experience. Every so often, while Yuzha Wang was performing this playlist that was spontaneously, you know, responding to the art on the walls, every so often there was a camera that might show her face or her hands. She, if you, you know, are not familiar with this pianist's work, you know, online. I mean, it's. I think some of her videos are somewhat viral because she really is, you know, quite something on the keys, an explosive, you know, virtuosic player, and gets all over the place. So that is exciting. I'll summarize the end of this here. So the idea, I think, that this author emphasizes is that, first of all, what she's doing did not distract from Hockney, that in fact the author felt like this was added value in a way, and that, you know, offered a commentary in the artwork that added to the artwork, that brought out another level. I think some of the things that were maybe surprising would be that the boulez, for example, isn't something that you might think of as, you know, something that you might enjoy, you know, out of context, but that somehow playing the boulez music, this postmodern music, accompanied by this postmodern art, added to boulez and to Hockney. He appreciated the just the energy of Yuzha Wang's playing. And he says at the end of this, this triggered a subversive thought. Why can't all solo recitals be like this? Why won't Carnegie Hall enhance its pianists with works of Pissarro or Picasso from the Metropolitan Museum? Why can't we have live close-up of face, hands, hairstyle, legs in the recapitulation section of every overlong sonata? Think about it. We've reached a point in the performing arts where concerts are half deserted while art shows sell out years in advance. Fuse them and see what happens. Finally, he summarizes that this revolution is proposed by Yuzha Wang, the hottest current concert pianist, is all the more intriguing. Yuzha has not yet earned a reputation as an original thinker or trendsetter, except in her skirt lengths. May I pause for a moment and just say, he continues, wittingly or otherwise, she has just cracked the wall that Boulez and his gang banged their heads against. His final sentence, if this is the music of the future, I like the sound, the sight, and the inclusivity of it, as Chuck Berry once sang, roll over Beethoven, tell Tchaikovsky the news. So my question for you, Eric, in my opening salvo is, have we seen the future of music? What do we mean if we're talking about the future of music? How do we respond to what this critic is proposing? This critic excited enough to hear this concert in person and to blow through the non-disclosure agreement that was signed in blood. Can we talk about the future of choral music? Does that mean anything?
Well, let's start.
I toss it to
you. Let's start here. I'm going to, in review, or as a sort of broad explanation of what happened, he states in a sentence that Yuja Wong harnessed visual technology to play music in three dimensions for all five senses and an undifferentiated audience. So I think that's what this person thinks of as the future of music, that sentence, where music is played in what could be seen as three-dimensional, in a three-dimensional environment for all five senses and an undifferentiated audience. But the when I think about that, I think I've had that before, though. And it's when you when I purchased a ticket to a movie where they put you in a seat where they send smells through the theater and wind blows under your seat and they can shoot snow out of play. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Okay, so first of all, my question in listening to this, and I also want to, you know, put a little bookmark in and say, I'd love to see this performance. It really sounds interesting, and you know, I'd be really interested to experience what Yuja Wong has come up with here, because she really is quite a player. Now back to the question. So first of all five senses.
Yeah,
you know, in this concert, we don't where's the smell? We don't know.
Right.
But I think to what you're saying, Eric, you know, yeah, like my thought was, well, if the future of music is engaging more senses, in another way, like we do have musical, you know, genres and art forms that do engage more senses, right? So you can think about, you could think about opera, you could think about a film in which, like I've experienced that, in Texas, there's a, I think in San Antonio, no, in Austin, in the Texas History Museum, you can sit down and there's this moment when you're watching this video about Texas independence, where they talk about there's like a rattlesnake or something, and then the seats kind of like move and it feels a little stingy, which is a weird experience, but I always thought that was kind of cool when I was a kid. You know, there are ways to experience in more senses than just sound. And maybe that something that differentiates this, I think, in what the critic is proposing is that it seems like you're adding the performer into this mix in a slightly different way. So it seems like one thing that he enjoyed was not just the art, but also that you got the performer in projection from time to time. So it's like you were able to enjoy the virtuosity of that. And I would say, like, you know, if you're talking about the next 100 years of performance, that really is kind of a bold and I think hyperbolic statement. Also to say that Yuja Wong is only known for creativity and skirt lengths, I think is just really unfair.
Wait, Richard?
I've
got another one, though. I mean...
Okay.
Imagine... I mean, you don't have to imagine. Another situation came to mind. A ninth grade Sadie Hawkins dance. Okay? You go to the local gym that has some bad lights connected to the ceiling. There is a local band playing that they might have a projector projecting a screen of the band playing, you know, whatever songs kids like now in ninth grade. So you are immersed in every sense. and there are projections. Mm-hmm. You smell the gym and the Axe body spray all these ninth grade boys put on. Mm-hmm. You're dancing. You are moving. You are seeing. You are hearing. I'm just wondering, is just the addition of sight a move toward, quote, future? Because kind of that's what's happening here. There's sort of a sight and more than just sight, but sort of a virtual sight element to this. And mm-hmm. and because it was curious what you said. What did you want to do? You didn't want to hear this concert. You said you wanted to see this concert. It's a mm-hmm. curious yeah. thing that you said. So is that when we say the future of music, are we actually thinking of music or are we thinking of entertainment? I mean, the future of entertainment that music is a piece of. That's my question. I mean, because does music have anything to do with sight, really? Or is it a purely oral thing in the end? It's just a question for you.
Yeah, I mean, that's... So if we're going to, I think, be really careful about terminology and word choice and all of that, I think, even the title of this article, Have I Seen the Future of
right,
Music?
That's right.
Like, think about it. And so I think what the author's really getting at maybe is that, I don't think the author has seen the future of music. And I don't think that, like, even in this situation, the composer did not, add the visual aspect. David Hockney did not select a playlist. The people who put together the exhibition selected the artwork, and then Yuja Wang provides the playlist. And so in a way, perhaps what the author's getting at is more, have we seen a way to enliven, what he obviously thinks is a stale recital culture? And if that's the case, I think that like so many things, this stuff moves in waves. We tend to treat our past experiences or our childhoods or whatever as the baseline for history, and then everything we do is a reaction to this thing. But so much of concert culture, as we've talked about in previous programs, is a reaction toward and an embrace of technology. This is another embrace of technology. We've discussed on this program before how the idea of being quiet in a concert and the idea that what performers are trying to do is to recreate a pristine oral experience because of, recording technology. Like that's not forever. And I think if you went back, let's go back to the Renaissance and Josquin des Prez. I mean, if you're performing some polyphonic mass, the people listening, without being in a performance, would have experienced that in all five senses. They would have smelled incense. They would have, experienced cold or heat, depending on what time of year it is. They would have heard. They would have felt. The people next to them. Those are more embodied ways, maybe, of thinking about the musical experience. But all of those things are not the music. It's what we experience when we're there. I think if a composer decided, to then intentionally add, and composers do. I mean, there are plenty of examples of this. So it's not like groundbreaking that a composer would, choose visual accompaniment, or a slideshow or something like that. This in this exact way, it's been happening since the 1950s and in what you would recognize as kind of a modern sensibility about this. So I think what he's really getting at is concert. This critic finds concerts to be boring. And here's a dynamic performer who let us see, you know, what she was doing, and somehow she was the equal of Hockney, you know, like equaled that to the Sadie Hawkins dance then, right? Like, what's the problem with this? Well, who's the equal of Hockney? You know, like what performers really stand up to that? And the answer is, you know, in another way, you write out a certain kind of experiential quality here, because to match, you know, Hockney means you've got to find the right music. I think about silent films, and I love silent movies so very much. I love that they are so focused on the visual, but also that there's this underrated relationship to music in these films and these wonderful old scores that some pretty amazing composers like Korngold and Saint-Saëns, you know, was one of the first composers that wrote what we would consider a masterpiece of film composition, because he lived such a long life that he was able to not only live in the, you know, the grand romantic era, but was able to write a film score. Then you hear modern composers maybe trying to reimagine things, and some of them are amazing, and some of them not so much. You know, it's interesting to see who is actually the equal of some of those masters of early silent film. And that's not to say that it can't be done, but it is to say that you really have to, you know, humble yourself then, I think, as a performer and as a composer, to understand what it is that you're putting yourself up against. It's not like you could just take any concert and make it work, I guess.
I want to go back, though, and really, like, drill really hard down into the concept that of divorcing the idea of music away from the performance of music. Because that, I think that's, again, what, when we say we've seen the future of music, mm-hmm. we're not talking about music. We're talking about the application of music, the application of the thing. Mm-hmm. I believe. So an example that I could say of something that could have been seen as really the future of music, where a sense was applied in a musical way that wasn't its own entity on its own. Like when you're saying the example of music being applied to cinema, that mm-hmm. cinematic experience is still separate from the music. Or mm-hmm. Another one would be like cartoon music. That's another great one where there is an interplay that's happening constantly. But you could still take the cartoon music away from the cartoon, and it would have worth and value on its own.
Sure.
So the sensation of seeing, you're still not seeing the music. You're seeing something that rides alongside, isn't like two vehicles riding alongside each other. That's what I think. But here's an example where another sense is being applied to music itself. And I would put out there the Prometheus poem of fire by Scriabin, which included, I'll just read here for a minute, which includes a part for a machine known as a clavier à lumière, also known as a luce, a color organ designed specifically for the performance of Scriabin's tone poem.
Right.
It was played like a piano, but projected colored light on a screen in the concert hall rather than sound. Most performances of the piece have omitted now this light element, although a performance in New York City in 1915 projected colors onto the screen. So why do I bring this one up? Because Scriabin, I think if I recall, had synesthesia.
He did, yes.
And so every note had a particular light value. So this is what I mean by differentiating the sensory feeling from having experienced a performance versus the sensory is held within the actual piece. Like you can see the vibrations somehow mm-hmm. in the way that that light is being distributed on the screen mm-hmm. purposefully by the composer. Another way might be touch and saying, I can feel the score if you were blind. And you could mm-hmm. actually feel the music happen somehow. Or mm-hmm. like an LSD trip or something where you can see the music. I've never done this.
Next episode.
Right. Well, do you kind of know what I'm talking about here? I feel like the future of music was in 1910, and it stopped. And here we're left with replacements and trying to find ways to jerry-rig the future by having performances that do have... I'm just going to be very abrasive to say that why isn't hearing the music enough? Why isn't it enough? There must be some reason why it's not enough. So we have to add cinema and sort of gratuitous filming of her legs as she's performing over long sonatas is what he said. But I think
that was tough.
I'm saying the real future of music was a color organ that was never developed upon. Or what we talked about, the future of music is the use of technology to do things like, one thing I might have brought up in this episode is something called vaporwave, which is a current phenomena where you're taking music from the past and riffing on it in a new way. So the fusion, in other words, fusion would be mm-hmm. Perhaps the real future of music. And if you wanted to add other sensory elements, it would have to be done by the composer, mm-hmm. not essentially just partnering it, because we've experienced then the future of music for a long time, and it's called movies, right?
Yeah, this reminds me of just a couple of aesthetic questions that you hear about and questions of interpretation and meaning. And, you know, in a really basic sense, I would say yes, like the I don't find the idea of melding these things together to be the future. You know what I mean? In fact, in a way, I think it's reclaiming the past in a bit, in a way of thinking. So that's the first deal. And again, like I said, you know, we always project backward what we have experienced, you know, in our fairly immediate past. And for the critic to imagine that, you know, recitals throughout history have been these cultivated antiseptic kind of experiences is to not really have been paying attention. You point out all of the experimentation with visual aspects in the early 20th century, many of which I think were way more, you know, like, wild and provocative. One of my favorite examples is, and I love Alban Berg, Berg's operas. In the opera Lulu, there's this wonderful moment where, in the dead center of the opera, there's a film that is shown, and he scores this film, and there's a moment when a bell rings and suddenly the entire score begins to move in retrograde from itself. So this moment, and the film is playing forward and then it flips and it starts playing, you know, it starts laying out the information in the opposite way. It's such a wonderful moment. I almost don't want to give it away, but if you're, you know, if you don't know Lulu, I think those His works are just fantastic.
We're not into about spoilers, his, Richard. We don't do spoilers on this show.
That's right. We don't do spoiler alert. Don't want to give away the key moment in Lulu if you have not yet seen this. But and of course, you know, people will be lining up now.
Right.
They're going to just want to go see the film sequence in Lulu. So, but like, you know, take this then and think about the way that this relates to another aesthetic question. So you're asking, you know, why can't we maybe, you know, one way of expressing what you've said is, well, we've, you know, is the music enough? Is it not enough? Right. What are we adding to music? What are we saying that we add when we add these other things? Are we then adding to the music, or are we creating something that is this other thing? I'm reminded of a question of aesthetics, which is, do you have to appreciate, you know, like, is there really, do we in all music that we listen to actually bring context into it that helps us to appreciate it? It's not that we can't appreciate music on its own terms, but it's if you have that extra layer, do you appreciate it more or in a different way? So when we talk about film scores, I think we do and can appreciate the beauty of film score on its own terms. But do we, and I, you know, I don't know the answer to this, but is it the case that we appreciate the soundtrack to Star Wars a little more when we know who the characters are and what they accompany? Is it the case that we, you know,
can we pause
in opera,
on that one, Richard? Hold it in mind. Uh-huh.
Okay.
You just had a perfect question. I just want to emphasize it for myself. Mm-hmm. You said we could enjoy the music of Star Wars more if we knew what?
The characters.
Right. You didn't say if we are watching the scene, it's if we know the story, right? It's a knowledge of the story, not the other senses. It's a knowing the meaning behind the music, not any additional sensory application. I guarantee you that has nothing. You don't need to have the people that enjoy that are they don't need the visual to fully encapsulate the sort of rejoiced memory of the song, right? Maybe the first time. Are you saying maybe the first time they needed it?
Well, I mean, that's really interesting. That's an interesting question. I had not thought of it that way. And so let's try and think of an example in which, you know, the visual would be integral. I wonder if that's possible. I'm going to give a couple of examples. And tell me what you think. So there's a very famous, I'll lay both of these out before you respond. So there's a super famous concert work that everyone knows, the Mussorgsky Pictures and an Exhibition, which was a direct, like, which was composed specifically for the show. And each of those movements is a painting that you can see. And that is, you know, it, literally the title is what, you know, this Hockney thing that Yuja Wang did to an extent is. So, but most people don't look at this art at all and wouldn't know that original context. So is it the case there that Mussorgsky has, you know, overcome that and that the music is actually adding value to those paintings? Another thing, though, and I wonder what you think about this. I assume you've seen, you know, or that our listeners have seen 2001, A Space Odyssey. The Strauss, Also Sprach Zarathustra, that is used so unforgettably in that film, accompanies not a, and this, I think, is the magic of this film and of what for me is the best cinema, you know, that transcendent, slow, quiet, where, you know, in this case, the first time it's used it's accompanying a very striking visual moment. You can't really say that it's accompanying a narrative, but it's accompanying an image. And I wonder if that image has added value to the Strauss in the imagination of appreciators of art. Like, I feel like that piece probably is as well known as it is because of that image in the movie.
But we're,
and I wonder if you agree.
But we're sort of changing the subject to adding value to it rather than changing the definition of it. Or, right? Is the future of music adding value to music? Is that, you know what I mean? Or finding greater value in it? Or, you know, it's this.
Well, I mean,
this
reminds
me
wonder.
Of music decorating time. We're.
Well, sure.
Is music, this is the exact same question, only we're replacing the word time with music. So in other words, we're one degree off of what we were talking about before with music decorating time, and now we're talking about things decorating music to give it what? Value? Purpose? Meaning?
But I think that's his thing, right? Like that's what that author is trying to say is, do we, is the future of music, like, let's really try and strongman this argument that he's making, which I think is not terribly well thought out. But is it the case that, you know, he's almost arguing this is what music must become. It must be additive. We must add this other sensory element.
Because it's insufficient. Meaning away. It's insufficient on its own. In some way. That's why music halls are half full, right? Because it's going to die on its own because it's too boring. We don't have the and even how he phrased sonatas, I mean, as overly long. We don't have the brain capacity to sit there and enjoy music on its own, right? We need flamboyant performers with three-dimensional screens projecting things now just to enjoy Satie, right?
Well, or that this is the way that people will eventually choose to express themselves musically, right? Like that the music itself, quote unquote, won't be enough. Again, if I'm trying to strong man the argument, that's where I'm going with it. Now, and I would argue then to go back to the question of meaning and context and all of this, that in a weird way, this is not the future of music. This is the past of music. Mm-hmm. This is there is a moment that actually in the long history of music is probably pretty small in which you actually would have this more abstracted form of musical enjoyment. I mean, that one question that is, you know, writers on aesthetics ask is whether, if you take a work of socialist, if you take a socialist kind of informed piece of artwork from the early 20th century from Russia, you know, as Russia became the Soviet Union, and in order to understand this work, you have to buy into, you know, an ideological framework. And if you buy into that framework, you will understand it with greater, you know, you will enjoy it. You will want to listen to it. To you, this is music. Writers about the I remember reading an article about the Verdi Requiem, and this author was saying, well, you know, really to enjoy the Verdi Requiem more, you have to, understand, or you have to like get the drama of all of this end of time imagery that comes within the Dies Irae of the Requiem Mass. Like if you don't know that, then you're not going to appreciate the music as much. And furthermore, this author argued if you don't believe it, which is funny because Verdi was fairly agnostic, you know, and was not what one would call a devout believer or something. But this author claimed that he was infected by the imagination, you know, of that as a cultural artifact for him. But, you know, the author would go on to say, or someone who takes that argument would go on to say that, you know, without any of that context, any of that, those cultural, you know, that artifice that culture would bring to it, you know, would you even recognize that as being powerful music? Would you just hear it as drums clanging and say, wow, why is this so loud, you know, at this moment? That's a question. Like, is the author then saying that the future of music is we will insist that more senses are engaged, that musicians will ask for this, that performers will ask for this? Is the person deciding about this future of music the composer or the performer or the audience? You know, like, and we've talked about that before, in other podcasts, but you know, I don't know where I fall in some of those questions. I think that it's, again, a little bit of hyperbole to insist that this, you know, we've seen it, because I think that we've already seen it, you know, that the idea that there's a little more to the performance is not necessarily a new thing.
No,
on its own.
I mean, and we haven't even talked about an entire musical art form, which is ballet. And
sure,
that composers are writing for their piece to be reacted to in movement. So again, I feel like his statement, I agree with you that it is, we are seeing the past only brought about by the use of technology. That's mm-hmm. what he mm-hmm. experienced at this.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm with you. I agree, actually, that just adding sensory elements is not necessarily the future of music.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it? Since you asked it at the outset, let's postulate what the future of music is. What are we talking about even?
Yeah, and you know, for a choral musician, what does that mean? Because I do think that, you know, we experience as people try to expand audiences or try to you know, compete for audiences or whatever, that they're trying to make choices to, and some of them are choices towards novelty, or, you know, trying to find what that next thing is. And I do think that, you know, in the immediate future, things will continue to move that way. I don't see that stopping right now. I think that it moves in waves. Mm-hmm. I don't think that our current moment will be that way forever. I think that in, you know, to go all the way back to our very first episode about anti-fragility and Taleb and all of that stuff, I think that, you know, some of this is the fact that the, you know, the musical art is now a scalable profession, meaning that you're not just making music in your town and you're not just making music for the community that is in front of you, but in order to, you know, encourage people to participate, you're also competing against this imaginary thing mm-hmm. that is all of the musicians on the planet. Yes. You know, like you might have a great concert, but you're also competing against a viral YouTube video when you present that. Yeah. And that's what, you know, it's interesting to me that Yuzhou Wang, who is an online star, you know, because her videos are shared and all of that, the fact that she's the one that is bringing this about, because she's already proven that she can do it, right? Like, you've already shown that you are visually captivating if you have succeeded on that level. So of course this would be, you know, to experience that in person, you know, and everything. Well, this person has you know, is a huge player, you know, in that world of scalable musicality. And I think yeah, you'll have to continue to play that game to some extent until people tire of it. And I don't think that will take 100 years.
No.
You know, I think it will, there will be some kind of a different thing, just because of the weariness of it. I think we've seen this in the way that social media, you know, is consumed in a different way now than it was even 5 years ago, because people are just tired.
Yeah.
I think they're overwhelmed. And I just think audiences will, at some point, they'll be like, oh, give me a break, you know, let me just listen for a little bit.
I kind of wonder if this might be, speaking of hyperbolic, a bit hyperbolic, but what do you think about this as the future of music, that with the decay and collapse of potentially music education, music literacy in the West, that a return somehow to nationalism will come back, to cultural musical nationalism, where this sort of concept of homogeneity of entire, you know, like, as we've noted before, the music world, to me, it follows similarly to corporate groups and corporate leanings, like, let's say, Monsanto and the farming community, or some mm-hmm. of these things, that everything becomes one thing. And then when the one thing collapses, we return to some sort of let's do it ourselves kind of thing. When, do you know what I'm trying to say? Like, the future of music yeah. might be, we need to get together, let's say in choral music, for instance, that these concepts of, as you said, large scale, the sort of idea that we have a cosmopolitan one system mm-hmm. and left behind are things like folk songs, folk, they're, you know, individualized, that are thought of as important to treasure and to retain as cultural identities through music. Michael McGlynn and I talked about that extensively when he was on this podcast several years ago. That the result will be, I like what you said, tired. That it'll be like, why does mm-hmm. everything we experience, is it, why is it all the same in a way? Why is it, where mm-hmm. is any variety of life? Oh, wait. I have a long history. Let's say you live in Britain. I have a long history of British folk song that has been in our heart, in our bodies, in our way throughout for the last 500 years, 600 years mm-hmm. or more mm-hmm. in some cases. Mm-hmm. I feel like,
well, yeah.
So I would say that partnered with a return to doing things at home, doing things in small ways, sort of like, you know, some sort of reformation of music in a way. I could be totally wrong, but I feel like there's a big wave of this swelling wave of sort of technology that will not fulfill music mm-hmm. progress, that is a shadow. It's not real, the idea of music progress, because mm-hmm. for one, we're human beings with a diminishing return of performance. We can't, what is progress in performance? That's probably mm-hmm. why we need to add other senses, is because we've reached thresholds of vocal performance. What else can we do? What can, so I heard Room Full of Teeth. There's not a whole lot more that we can do vocally here, you know, really, because we're organic beings. So we have to add technology. We have to add other things. And maybe that's why he's talking about this is the future of music. But I do think that I worry that that will essentially cause a less of a middle class and more of elitists versus people that can't. And that ties in a little bit with decay of music literacy, music education overall. And I don't know. So the future, I'm not saying the future is bleak. I think you're right that a pendulum stroke will swing in a different direction than the way it is currently.
Yeah, that's really, that brings up a lot of kind of big points, right?
of course. I mean, I know too.
To the literacy thing, you know, I think that's what is behind the comment that he makes about the overlong sonata, you know, and it's like if you don't know sonata form or you don't have any sense of expectation because you're not, you just don't listen to it the right way, I guess his idea is like, well, then why, you know, you're not sensing the excitement of a return to the one chord, you know, in the way that you might have a couple hundred years ago when there was less going on, you know.
Well, just think about what you just said, Richard. That's an amazing comment. When there was less going on. Isn't that funny? I mean, just as I think part of these conversations that we have are realizing where we are in and contextualizing them in where we are. And I don't know. It's just curious that the more choice we have, the less pleased we are.
You know. Oh, totally. You know, the other thing that your comments reminded me of, it's really interesting to think about something like a, you know, return to folk styles or you said nationalism, you know, and all of this. And I think that, you know, we have this different thing because the relationship of art to kind of this diffused commercialism, that pervades so much of like every facet of our culture, and it pervades concert culture too, because you begin to see artistic creation as a commodity that, you know, something to consume, and then you expect it to be packaged in a certain way and all of this. So what we would come back to now versus what, you know, people might have come back to 100 years ago or something. I think that's an interesting question. Although it reminds me of an argument that Umberto Eco makes in one of his essays in Travels in Hyperreality, when the essay is called like the New Middle Ages or the New Medievalism or something, where he said, actually, the more connected we get, there will come a point when we have this balkanization of ideas where we will have this like embrace of all of these different things, and the people won't see they won't agree, you know, they will sort of pull back. And I, you know, we've seen this in, you know, kind of national discourse and all of that. And so I think the idea that you would see that happen musically is interesting, you know, that you might end up with all of these different styles, and that could be an unforeseen result of this in a reaction against the homogeneity, and that it would actually be the result of more communication. I think that's really interesting, you know, and who knows? We won't know, you know, until we see it play out over the next decades or whatever. I think that there is I think that this article is a reminder also to consider as people who, you know, are helping people to experience music, both audiences and performers, what we can't take for granted about context and what is known, you know, and what people walk in with, because I think that less and less of that can be assumed. And you really are, you know, if there are things that you feel are worthwhile and to be valued, you do have to lay that groundwork. You do have to, you know, have to set the stage a little bit. That being said, you know, I think that I wonder if it's like the old medieval definition of beauty. You know, how do you know if it's beautiful? Well, if you think it looks beautiful, you know, that's how we know it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
And I do wonder about those questions aesthetically. Are there sounds that are just that you can't resist? You know, are there tendencies, and you know, is there an element of symmetry and order that we do organically respond to just because of our human nature? That's a good question too.
In conclusion, I want to return to somebody I mentioned previously, Scriabin, because he went beyond this Prometheus thing, and he died before he could imagine it. But there is a piece that was unrealized that he proposed and had started, mm-hmm. begun to write, which was his Mysterium. Have you heard of this piece, Richard?
I have.
So if you haven't heard it, I want you to look it up, because it's amazing. It would have been a week-long performance, which includes music, scent, dance, and light in the foothills of the Himalayas. And if it were to have ever been performed, it would have concluded the world, I guess. We would have transcended into something. I would have loved to have just sat with him as he described this thing, which, again, is the fulfillment. That's the ultimate, mm-hmm. fulfillment of what this person said is the future of music. It was thought of in 1911, probably. Mm-hmm. It's now 120. The future is 125 years old. So, good job, Ed. Or what was his name? Sorry. Norman. Sorry.
Norman. Good job. Sorry. Thanks, Ed.
Thanks, Todd. I mean, as usual, to conclude, the definition of terms when we talk about things really matters. It really does. And we can get caught being hyperbolic when we mean something and we say something. Because at face value, he might be right that the inclusion of more sensory would bring more people in.
Sure.
But I would respond very quickly by saying, remember what I said about the theater, where they would shoot in snow or wind, have smells happen at the times of the... Why aren't those everywhere? Could be cost-related, maybe. Or is it because it just is a fad and it goes away? And what remains is what really matters, which is whatever the cinema is providing is enough. Do you know what I mean? You don't need the feeling, mm-hmm. if it's cold, that you're watching Fargo at the movie and the entire thing is blowing cold air in your face, you know? So it's a curious thing to think through. And I think a lot of what we talked about is important to think through. Is music music? Or is ballet music?
Mm-hmm.
Is music, or is, I mean, do you know what I'm trying to say? Is music sound plus an X, whatever X is, sound plus, mm-hmm. X? Or is or is it sound?
Mm-hmm.
And that's, mm-hmm. I'm not sure, there's gray area there perhaps that I, you know,
yeah.
need to think through. Okay.
Yeah. Totally agree.
We've got
fascinating.
And by
stuff.
The way, maybe we should do a little show about synesthesia, because I think immersing ourselves for 30 minutes or an hour in synesthesia might be a lot of fun.
That could be a good one. Okay. Let's add it to the list. I love
that. Let's do it. Okay. Listener, I hope you go to this article, Have I Seen mm-hmm. the Future of Music? By Norman Lebrecht in thecritic.co.uk, and give this some thought and think, and maybe if you want, you can respond to us. What will the future of music, and perhaps choral music, but music in general, what actually is it? Because I think it's a bit murky.
Yeah. We'd love to hear from you, as always. You can drop us a line at thechoralcontrarians@gmail.com. Touch base on the Choral Contrarians Listeners Society on Facebook. And reach out. Let us know what you think. Eric, this has been fun.
Define fun.
Stop.